This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from this great book by Carl Safina, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002 by Henry Holt and Company. I'll read again some of the last paragraphs from last week because it's so important to what we're going to understand about island ecology. They're on a vessel that's left Honolulu and has been picking the scientists up who have been on remote islands for 5 months, with a new team of scientists to relieve them for another 5 months, and heading for a few days north of Tern Island to Lazen Island and Lisianski Island, and talking with the biologists on board and the crew. And when they reach Lazen, when they disembark, they have to wear clothing that is brand new and recently frozen. There are rules for going ashore here, and they're unlike anything you've ever heard of. Any clothing, all clothing, must be brand new. New shoes, new socks, new shoelaces, new underwear, new hats. And everything has to be frozen for several days until the minute before you put it on for shore landing. This leads to the interesting sensation of donning frosted underwear. Jerry Leinecke of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did a pretty convincing job of explaining the rationale. Jerry has devoted 15 years to protecting and restoring these islands. He appealed to me, "Please don't think our rules are silly. It's hard to get people to understand why they need new shoes and frozen underwear. But if you're me behind the budgets, you realize that introduction of an alien grass may mean crashes in seabird populations or even extinction of a species, and that it will cost a decade and millions of dollars to get a type of grass off of an island because somebody had seeds on their socks." His example is not hypothetical. The grass they've been trying to eradicate was probably introduced to Lazen as a seed on a scientist, perhaps on their shoelace or in their pant cuff. If it seems like a long shot that it arrived here accidentally via scientist clothing, consider this. I noticed it growing right out of the wharf in Honolulu, where the research boat docks. Leinecke continued, "Something as simple as ants hiding in cardboard boxes can change the ecology of whole islands. The ants now introduced on those islands need moisture, and one of the only moisture sources is hatchling birds. I've seen chicks get eaten alive by introduced ants." After hearing that, putting on frosted underwear seems the least I can do to help. And hidden in his comments is an interesting point. When, like Petra, you wake up with thousands of ants stuck to the sweat on your body, remember that no ants of any kind occurred naturally in Hawaii. They hitchhiked with people. These islands are excellent examples of places that exist within a fragile ecological balance. Because of their remoteness, the living things here have evolved specific ways of coexisting. Introductions of new things can threaten long and stable intimate relationships. Prior to people, neither native ants nor earthworms perturbed Hawaiian soils. No amphibians, no land reptiles, no terrestrial snakes, no frogs, no lizards, nary a mosquito. Prior to the Polynesians, no mammal's foot had ever fallen upon Hawaiian rock. Hawaii's largest native land animal was a small goose, now endangered. Since the Polynesians and Europeans arrived, much of Hawaii's native fauna has been driven extinct or to extinction's brink by the rodents, diseases, insects, and plants that tend to round out our luggage. The alien grass, centrus, or sand burr, was first noticed on Lazen in the 1960s. It's native to Central America, but has spread worldwide thanks to tenacious little seed burrs that cling to everything. As late as the 1980s, its consequences here weren't recognized, and visiting scientists were not directed to even check their socks for seeds. By the early 90s, it was out of control, covering a third of the island with dense mats, displacing the native bunch grass. Trading one grass for another might not seem problematic, but to wildlife, The grasses differ radically. The native grass is needed by birds. The sand burr repels the birds. Many birds rely on the native bunch grass for nesting because its tall blades flop over, forming little hollows that provide critical shade for surface nesters like tropic birds, Christmas shearwaters, lazen ducks, and the lazen finch. The bunchgrass roots also support burrows for underground nesters like Bonin petrels. Conversely, the sandburr's dense, mat-like growth excludes surface birds, and its root structure causes burrows to collapse. The combination makes it a real threat to the birds. So the Fish and Wildlife Service decided to control or possibly eliminate the evil weed. The project's been a huge success because it exploits one of humanity's chief talents, a predilection to eradicate living things. The young interns here are titled restoration ecologists. That's a glamorous way of saying weed puller. But the work is critical to hundreds of thousands of birds at risk of losing their nesting habitat and, in the case of the lazen finch and the lazen duck, their last toeholds on existence. The work is even more important because few places like this remain. These islands are, as Dr. Beth Flint of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service emphasizes, essentially the only undisturbed seabird nesting islands left in the Pacific. That's true now, but Lazen was for decades plagued by problems wrought by the few people who reached here. Ironically, Lazen once had a different vegetation problem. It was devegetated. Rabbits released in 1903 multiplied, true to cliche. They had no predators, and the vegetation here had no evolutionary experience with grazers. By 1923, virtually nothing growing remained. When the Tanager expedition arrived at Lazen in April that year, photographer Donald R. Dickey wrote, "In my wildest pessimism, I had not feared such utter extirpation of every living plant. This is a glaring desert. The utter lack of green relief makes the drifted coral sand almost unbearable to the eyes." He reported only two small patches of close-cropped weed that still support a remnant of the cursed host. The Tanager team brought poisoned alfalfa, a kind of Trojan Mr. Green Jeans. All of Lazen's famished rabbits ravaged the roosts and died. But by then, most land birds were already extinct or doomed. Seabirds requiring shade, such as tropic birds, were scarce. Dickey wrote in April 9, 1923, "Not a trace of rail or honey eater or miller bird could we find." But 2 days later, one of the party found three honey eaters in a tobacco patch, which the rabbits, though starving, would not eat. Dickey remarked that their charming song is out of proportion to their size, adding, "Old age and death now inevitably stalk this childless remnant of a vanishing species." 12 days after that, a sandstorm finished the last three lazen honey eaters. A few days later, the party saw the last two doomed rails on Lazen. Some lazen rails had been transplanted to Midway a few years earlier, where they thrived until rats arrived. Somehow the lazen finch survived, as did the lovely duck, which was down to fewer than 10 individuals. Their future remains uncertain. Some of the problems the ducks now have, such as their chronically poor reproduction, probably result from extreme inbreeding, stemming from the time when they were flickering at the edge of extinction. We anchor offshore and spend several hours loading enough supplies for half a dozen working scientists to survive and thrive until the planet has conveyed us all to the far side of the sun. We transfer hundreds of water jugs and waterproof buckets of food, clothing, equipment, and books over the side of the ship and into inflatable outboard boats. Eventually, it's time for us to crack open our crisply frosted underwear and go ashore ourselves. Stone reefs are piling treacherous breakers where we must land. There's one little opening in the reef. We have to go through it. Our boat pilot, John Sykes, must time our arrival carefully. He maneuvers our boat just ahead of one of the swells, then guns it as the wave is cresting, so that for a minute we're almost surfing. The commander, Dr. Lampkin, is with us. And for a moment we're all yelling like cowboys. Lampkin shouts to Sykes, "And we pay you for having fun like this." With surprising smoothness, the craft slides onto a white sandy beach necklaced with a gleaming line of lapping wavelets. All along the shoreline stand little groups of brown noddies, sprinkled like handfuls of raisins in the sugary sand. Sykes says he can't imagine spending 5 months here. I can. Russ Bradley, who has been here for 5 months, and looks it, is on the beach. He has unruly, curly blonde hair and a woolly blonde beard. He's almost too eager to greet us, instantly super talkative, almost too friendly. "You guys got lucky with the weather for landing, real lucky. Yesterday we had 8-foot waves where you landed. Last week, forget it, we had 15-footers. They were just spectacular, but you couldn't have come in, no way." He abruptly adds, "Excuse me if I'm overly chatty. We've been the only people for 400 miles. In fact, he's so chatty that he reminds me of a scene from the book Cry of the Kalahari, when the two authors realize they're compulsively talkative after emerging from months in the African bush. Russ suddenly says, "I hope you don't think that I'm talking too much." Like that scene in the Cry of the Kalahari where they come out of the bush and overwhelm everyone. Michelle Reynolds, a biologist who has been working with the endangered ducks, also comes to greet us. "There's a lot to do while we talk. Mainly, we have to move about 250 sealed buckets and water jugs from the beach to the tent camp. Some buckets have essential equipment. Some say things like Alex, bathing suits, flip-flops, hats, or Petra, coffee. The new gang's all here. Brenda, Petra, Alex, and Rebecca for the next 5 month stint. And Ray Boland has come ashore briefly. Even compared to Tern Island, Lazen sets a new standard for remote. Tern Island, with its runway and barracks and administrators and boats and videos and various work teams, seems a booming human metropolis compared to Lazen's castaways living in tents. And while Tern hums with wildlife, Lazen roars. The birds are incomparably more abundant, something I could not have imagined. Tern Island has perhaps 100,000 sooty terns, which seems like a lot when you're trying to shout over them, but Lazen has something like 1 million. Here, you feel the heat of life at full burn. Lazen seems like a place we're not meant to see, as if you've put the whole world behind you. The initial impression here is of such stunning island beauty that I almost cannot see. I automatically overlook the beach debris washed ashore from all points Pacific. Veils of rain have smudged the western sky a while, but it's been sunny and hot here. Now I turn and notice a heavy dark cloud steamrolling our way. Hardly have I finished saying it looks like rain when strike the first drops of a pelting, stinging storm driven by unruly gusts. The good ship Cromwell, big and white as she is, and anchored less than a mile off, disappears behind thick curtains of downpour. The sky behind us darkens to an angry-looking blue-black bruise, but the foreground brightens, and now the light becomes extraordinary. The white fairy terns are no longer white. They're glowing like luminous flying pearls. When the rain clears, we walk up the beach for a wider view. From here, we can see albatrosses for acre upon acre, over the dunes and in the swales, over 2 gently undulating miles. So dense are they that in the distance the bright breasts of Lazen albatrosses, their black capes notwithstanding, whiten the ground. We go up to the tents. One is the kitchen and headquarters. The others are for sleeping and storing some supplies. Water jugs, equipment barrels, waterproof buckets, and scientific gear surround the tents as if we're all shipwrecked. Tame Lazen finches that exist nowhere else are poking around the buckets and gear. Take off your sandals to go inside, and a fearless, curious finch or two will immediately investigate your abandoned footwear. They're rather drab-looking, but after the honking and wailing and croaking and braying of seabirds, the finch's sweet call provides a startling reminder of the continents, of land, of home. You have to be careful getting out of your tent. You could easily step on a young albatross. One large chick outside my tent is playing with a sock that has fallen from a clothesline, shaking it like a puppy would. There's no outhouse, just an outdoor seat over a pit latrine, surrounded by bushes on three sides, with a wide view of the sea. The latrine, the loo, is referred to by the Hawaiianized term the lua. One brown noddy likes sitting at the lua with you, only half an arm's length away, communing at the commode's commanding view. What's life like here for months on end? We ask Michelle Reynolds what they've been eating recently. She answers, canned food. We ran out of tofu a few months ago, then onions. That really hurt. Then we ran out of cans of those nicely cut string beans. She turns abruptly to me and says, so what's happening in the world? Considering where I've been recently, I'm not the best person to ask. I punt. Russ is part of the team that's been here, but he got far enough into the outside world today to have an answer, and he's eager to share. He tells everyone here that he went on board the Cromwell in the afternoon and drank orange juice. Everyone in his cohort is so impressed and envious, it's a little spooky. Brenda comments, you get inventive here, especially with cooking. We don't just open a can. We make real meals. We are allowed to grow bean sprouts in jars, and we bake bread. We have a good system of fresh sprouts, and we have a good yogurt culture. Michelle adds, and a really great sourdough starter that we've made from leftover gravy that went bad in the propane refrigerator. After 5 months on Lazen, when the workers returning to civilization glimpse Honolulu's twinkling seaboard from the ship's rail, they say things like, this is overwhelming. They seem sincerely astonished by all the lights and the buildings. Ashore, they may report that they can't keep pace with the conversation. A little embarrassed, they'll say, excuse me, but the conversation seems to be streaming past me. Petra explains, the island becomes your world. You almost don't want to know what's going on outside. Every day is a new adventure to see what's changed with the birds or what the sea has cast up. You're not tied to house or car payments. Once you live out here, you realize how many of the things we can't live without are really unimportant. Your expectations change in other ways, too. Like you expect the islands will be pristine because they're so far away. But when you see the washed-up trash, it blows your mind. You'll see it when you get a chance to walk around. Then you realize nothing is really remote. Near sunset, Michelle, Rebecca, and I walk down long, grassy slopes on narrow trails to the shore of the Salt Lake. Thousands of Lazen albatrosses line the lake, but the main thing we seek is a look at a lucky duck. These ducks are secretive, hard to see, small. A standing duck could find shade under an albatross's tail. These ducks were breeding on the nearby island of Lisianski as recently as the mid-1800s. They lived on Maui, Kauai, Oahu, and the Big Island of Hawaii until the Polynesians arrived and found them literally sitting ducks. Now Lazen is the duck's last stand. The goal of the research is to understand how many ducks exist and the population trend. The last formal population estimate was 10 years ago. Since then, a population crash caused by drought, food shortages, and parasite infestations knocked the numbers down by about half. They stand now at around 350. It's Rebecca's job to continue the duck studies and, in a sense, to continue the ducks themselves. Many are her tasks. She has to count carcasses to see who died. Because the ducks eat flies, she has to count how many flies land on a sheet of light cloth placed every 20 meters along a transect. She has to count brine shrimp, which the ducks also eat. She has to do observations of individual birds, noting all their behaviors. She has to get samples of duck droppings. She has to do radio tracking. After broods hatch, she has to follow duckling survival. The only job the ducks have is trying to survive. But it's full time. Today a frigate bird came down to take a duckling from a brood on the lake. So furiously did the mother duck leap up to defend her baby that the frigate bird, a monster many times the duck's size, gave up the attack and left. For the moment, the duck's domain seems placid, and we're fortunate enough to find a brood we can observe through binoculars, a female and her following balls of down, chowing brine flies. The seething swarms of brine flies here, along the shoreline and at my feet, are matched by the seething swarms of sooty terns now in the air overhead. This is what something approaching a million birds begins to look like. Alfred Hitchcock got worked up over a few dozen gulls. It didn't take much to scare him. I'm going to stop there. I can't help but think of the comparison between all the work being done to keep seeds from traveling from people's socks and shoelaces and shoes and pants cuffs and pockets onto these islands. Compare that to garlic mustard here around us being spread by all-terrain vehicles, logging equipment, and shoelaces and pants cuffs. Garlic mustard, when it goes to seed, gets very tall and can drop into the pockets in your jacket. I always try to be sure that if I've been in garlic mustard, I do not carry seeds with me anywhere. I think this is a great lesson for everybody to be able to recognize it and to take precautions. I also have some seasonal observations to make right now during these gorgeous days of September. I have done whole programs on going up to see migrating hawks at Hawk Ridge, just east of Duluth, Minnesota. The southward migration is kicking in full force, and I want to remind you about taking a weekend or some days during the week and traveling up there for the spectacle. The hawks tend to bunch up in large numbers as they don't want to fly over a large body of water like Lake Superior, so they tend to follow the shoreline as they're heading south. And Hawk Ridge is a world-renowned spot for seeing lots and lots of different species of hawks and eagles and falcons and osprey and migrating songbirds. They do it all up there. It's a terrific bunch of biologists counting and studying these birds. There's a website to look at if you're curious about this, and it'll help you with lots of information on visiting Hawk Ridge. Look for hawkridge.org. Their Hawk Weekend Festival is September 19th through the 21st. I guarantee you will enjoy your trip up there. It's a wonderful place to be along the north shore of Lake Superior. Not all that far away. And be sure to jot down in your calendar on the 17th of September, the WDRT Fall Fundraiser. At 8 o'clock in the morning, Dave Creer and I will be interviewing none other than Laura Erickson. She's coming to town. She lives right in Duluth, and she lives right at the foot of the ridge where Hawk Ridge is located. She knows it well. It's her backyard. And so we'll definitely be talking about it with Laura Erickson. That's on the 17th at 8 o'clock in the morning. And another seasonal event I wanted to mention is that I'm noticing, and maybe you are too, tent caterpillars have woven their tents. Please don't think that you need to grab any insecticide to go after them. We have cuckoos that specialize on feeding on hairy caterpillars, the kind that make these tents. And insecticides are so poorly regulated and so highly toxic to all insects. The black-billed and the yellow-billed cuckoos are so good at what they do that I beg you not to use ever an insecticide on anything. And on top of that, the tent caterpillars aren't going to do any lasting damage to your trees. It's easy to overreact when you see them, but over the long period of time, they won't be doing any harm. So that's it for now. I'm reading Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival by Carl Safina, published in 2002. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.